Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, it's bird news with Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Hi, Mark.
Good morning.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Mark, beaches are where it's at, right, as it is peak shorebird migration?
Yes, this is a wondrous time of year. It is really peaking now. And so all of these shorebird species that don't nest around here, you know, people might be familiar with things like the piping plovers and maybe even oyster catchers and the willets that scream at you when you're in the marshes all summer. But most of the shorebirds that pass through Cape Cod nest elsewhere, like the Arctic, basically. And so they're, you know, in June, they're up in coastal tundra in Alaska, northern Canada, you know, Baffin Island, Hudson Bay, all these far-flung places. But they have a very short breeding season, so by early July, they're already on the move. Things like semi-palmated sandpipers, semi-palmated plovers, a lot of semi-palmated things, partially webbed toes. You know, they named these things because they had that they would shoot them, and then they had them in the hand. Like, oh, look, it has a partially webbed toe. Right. Completely useless for us in the field. But short-billed dowitchers, greater yellow legs, all of these different shorebird species, least sandpipers, they start showing up in early July. And then the numbers just keep building. The first ones to show up are the adults who abandon their young up on the tundra or wherever else, the, you know, bogs, subarctic bogs, somewhere up north, so usually some sort of wetland situation up north. And then the adults are here and they're haggard looking and, you know, missing feathers and smoking cigarettes, as I always say, 'cause they just raised their kids and now they're on their own, right? They're empty nesters and they're on their journey south without the kids. And then so the kids are back on the tundra kind of looking at each other like, anyone seen mom and dad? You know,
what do we do now?
What's next? Yeah. But instinctually, they know they have to get somewhere. It could be the other end of South America. It could be here where they're ultimately going for the winter, depending on the species and subspecies and individual. I still don't understand how different shorebirds figure out where they want to go for the winter. You know, things like sanderlings. Sanderlings are the ones that probably most people would encounter if you're just an average beachgoer, or say you're going to an ocean beach. If you come to the Cape and the beach you mainly go to is, you know, Nauset Beach or Marconi or something like that, one of the ocean beaches, then the shorebird you're most likely to see is a sanderling. It's a good kind of standard sandpiper to get to know, to understand these birds. They nest on high Arctic mountain slopes and other high Arctic places. And then, you know, you can see them almost year round here. They're just tough as nails. They'll be here all winter. Other shorebirds like semi-palmated sandpipers also nest up in the Arctic, but they leave, they completely leave North America for the most part in the winter. And then you have red knots, mm-hmm. another high Arctic nesting species that are not a standard one that the average tourist going to a beach would find. You kind of have to go look for them. And they're in relatively out of the way places like Monomoy. Most of them are in Chatham, where they're feeding on either young mussels or small shrimp, grass shrimp, things like that. But they're a little bit picky compared to the other shorebirds. Red knots are those beautiful in breeding plumage, but federally threatened shorebirds that eat horseshoe crab eggs in the spring.
I was gonna say, we see more of them in the spring, and right?
That, yeah. I'm sort of rambling here, but I just want to make a quick point about red knots. Yeah, we don't really see them here in the spring. They're in New Jersey, Delaware, Chesapeake Bay, anywhere with more horseshoe crabs than we have.
Got it.
So from South Carolina up through Chesapeake Bay, but then up as far as Monomoy. And increasingly, we know that they are at Monomoy in the spring because horseshoe crabs have been protected at Monomoy for 20 plus years. From all forms of harvest, and there's good habitat there. It's a beautiful wildlife refuge, wilderness areas, and so there are tons of horseshoe crabs there. And so red knots do go to Monomoy in the spring and eat horseshoe crab eggs. And Manomet, that organization that will probably come up a couple times in the shorebird context. They are the shorebird research and conservation organization, really in the hemisphere, sort of the premier organizations. There's a little building on the bluffs in Manomet. But they have gotten into studying red knots and their diet around here, particularly in Chatham. And they got some interesting results in the spring showing that from eDNA, this new technique that all the cool kids are doing, if you're not doing eDNA, then you're not doing, bird research. Horseshoe crabs came back as the most important food for the red knots, even through late summer, which is not what anyone would expect because that's a spring thing, right? But they primarily come through here in late summer, and either they're finding eggs, horseshoe crab eggs that didn't hatch, or the larvae. Maybe small larvae makes sense as something that red knots would eat because they eat small, crunchy things. They specialize in shellfish fat, like very small mussels and things like that. So eating little horseshoe crabs would make a lot of sense for red knots. And so that's really interesting to see that even the southbound migration, that was surprising to us, that horseshoe crabs are important to things like red knots. And there are pictures of shorebirds like Hudsonian godwit. Hudsonian godwit is this very sought-after, declining, big sandpiper, big, beautiful sandpiper with a long, slightly upcurved bill. Birders love godwits, right? Godwits are spectacular. And they're harder to find, harder to get to the places where they are. And there's pictures of them eating horseshoe crab eggs in late summer. So this is very interesting that it's not just a spring thing, and they may be a more important food source than we realize. And just kind of highlighting that we still need to continue to do more to protect horseshoe crabs because they're such an important keystone species in terms of food for shorebirds and other things. But yeah, keep an eye out for all these shorebirds. And just to circle back to where I started with sanderlings, the original point about where they spend the winter, watch a sanderling chasing the waves when you're at Marconi, wherever you are. And think about where it came from. It came from some high Arctic place where people don't go. And it may stay here for the winter, it may stay in Maine for the winter. Or it might go to southern South America. One of the weirdest experiences, I've mentioned this before, I was in the high Andes of Peru at a high elevation lake, and we're looking at flamingos, Andean flamingos, and or Chilean flamingos. And I look see these two birds, and they're sanderlings. Like, what are you doing? And it was considered unusual for there. Like, what are you doing at a high elevation lake in Peru if you could have spent the winter at, Coast Guard Beach. And it's just interesting. Like, how do they make what determines that decision? Is it an individual decision? Is it a subpopulation? Because there are sanderlings in Europe, they winter in all kinds of different places from the temperate world down, down through tropics and into the southern hemisphere. I find it very interesting. I don't know about you, Mindy. I find it fascinating.
No,
All
you
these
just never
mysteries.
know.
There's
You
so
never
many
know.
mysteries
Mysteries.
out there.
I know there are a lot of mysteries. So, switching over to breeding season, winding down. So we got what? Any are there any songbirds still breeding, or everybody done?
Yeah, there are always some late breeders, some by design and some determined by their breeding success earlier in the spring and early summer. So if they have the time, then a lot of the resident birds in particular will keep nesting. Like cardinals might have young in September. If they keep going, if they're doing well, or if they kept failing, they'll keep trying, right? If their nest kept getting predated, then they might keep trying if they have enough food resources to keep laying eggs and that sort of thing. And so you might see just some of those resident species still nesting. But most things are done, right? Hummingbirds are done. They don't keep going. They'll be mostly gone by mid-September. So you're seeing all the young ones sort of ambling around your feeders and butterfly bushes and things like I do here. But by design, goldfinches nest late. They start nesting in July in some cases. Some nest in the spring, but they're famous for waiting until the end of summer to even start nesting because they don't eat insects. They're waiting for seeds to come online from all the different, perennials, particularly things in the daisy family they like to eat. But you ever watch goldfinches? They're always picking at plants, and they're not picking insects, they're picking seeds.
Good to know.
I see them on I, they always I flush them off my Montauk daisies. I don't know what they're doing
Oh,
because
wow.
they haven't even flowered yet. So they have a wide range of different plant materials. They'll eat flower petals. I've seen them eating forsythia flowers in the spring, but they're dedicated vegans.
Funny.
So when they go to the bird family reunion, everyone else is rolling their eyes. Oh, here come the
Here
vegans.
come the seed
I don't know
eaters,
what I
yeah.
have for you. Let me check the fridge. Yep.
It's interesting. You got an email from Raymond in Truro, and he says, "I finally had bluebirds nesting a few years after I placed nest boxes here in North Truro. The second brood left the nest just yesterday. What really surprised me is that a gang of sparrows, I think juveniles of at least two species, have been harassing the adults. I often saw a bluebird land on a wire, and immediately a bunch of sparrows would land beside it. When the bluebird flew off, the sparrows would take off in pursuit. They even follow them to the nest box and curiously look inside. This behavior has gone on for weeks. I wonder what it all means." What does it mean?
Right. Yeah, that was an interesting email. And it turned out what he was calling sparrows, luckily there were photos. They were house finches, recently fledged house finches. And they're streaky, kind of sparrow looking, but they had that big finchy bill. And there are lots of them around. And it was clearly in the just even in the pictures, it was clear it was obsessed with these bluebirds. It was following them around. This was not something I was familiar with. And so I Googled it and it's a thing, it's just one of those, somehow it's never come up. I've never personally seen it. We have nesting house finches and we have nesting bluebirds at my office where I spend an awful lot of time and I've not seen it, but apparently house finches becoming groupies of bluebirds is a thing. And so my initial interpretation of this was, oh, clearly this recent fledgling house finch is mad that its parents aren't feeding it anymore. It sees this bluebird bringing in food to its chicks, and so it's hanging around hoping to be fed. And that might be what is happening in some cases, but when I looked it up, it's like, no, adult house finches do it. They just
Interesting.
hang around bluebirds, and it makes no sense. House sparrows, if anybody's getting confused, house sparrows are the non-native, essentially an old world weaver finch, not even really a sparrow. But they are famously problematic when you manage bluebirds because they will get into their cavity nesters and they will get into the bluebird houses and either destroy bluebird eggs and chicks if they're already nesting, or they'll get there first and they'll exclude the bluebirds. So the fact that it's house finches doesn't make a lot of sense because they're not cavity nesters. They're not competitors. They're not super similar. They're not closely related. It really is one of those bizarre phenomena that's just yet to be explained.
Another
And
mystery.
again,
Yeah, another
another
mystery.
mystery. Yes.
So we don't know why. They just, for whatever
No.
reason, they're fans of bluebirds, like
They're into
us. We
bluebirds.
like bluebirds too. Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone loves them.
866-999-4626 is our number for your bird comments, questions, or stories. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News This Morning with Mark Faraday. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Mark, you mentioned that we're seeing some of those recently fledged hummingbirds flying around, and they'll all mostly be gone in about a month. Cheryl has a hummingbird question. She says, "I was hoping you could provide me with some information regarding the hummingbird population this year. 2 years ago, I had consistently nearly 40. Last year, about 25. This year, I only have 6. Is this due to climate change, or is there another reason?"
No, it's not climate change, but I'm curious about these numbers. How would this person know that they have 60 hummingbirds?
Yeah, she did send a video with the 25 from last year, but I guess She just sees them at the feeder and like, maybe counts them. Yeah.
Where was this again?
She doesn't say where.
That's not, I can't even conceive of that.
Yeah, it's a lot.
I see one at a time. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes I'll say, oh, that's a male and there's a female. And a female comes one at a time. And they're probably different ones. I'm sure it's several ones from around the neighborhood. But I never, you know, I have hummingbird feeders out. I have mm-hmm. honeysuckle vines and, you know, butterfly bushes. I don't see more than two or three at a time ever. I can't conceive of anybody in the Northeast knowing that they have 60 hummingbirds.
I don't think did she say 60? She said 40 and then 25 oh, 40. Last year. Yeah.
Equal it. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, yeah. But 40 still.
Well, if Cheryl's listening, she should give us a call. And
I
can
would
ask
love
her
to
questions.
Know
yeah, Cheryl,
more about
866-999-4626. We'd love to hear more about your hummingbirds. I do remember
typically,
several years ago, I was over at somebody's house on the vineyard, and they had, I would say at one time, they had several feeders, and I bet they had about 10 that you could see humming around there.
Okay. I can see that. If you have a lot of feeders and you're a good spot, I can see that. But boy, 40. Mm-hmm. But that might be if we all banded our hummingbirds like Sue Finnegan mm-hmm. does. She bands at Wing Island Banding Station there at the Museum of Natural History, and she's one of two licensed hummingbird banders. It's a special license separate from other bird banding certification. And so she's licensed to band hummingbirds, and you know, we call her when we have rare hummingbirds that need to be identified, and she's very good at getting that done. But she has done it at her house, and you wouldn't know it. Like I say, you look out and there's one or two. But if you band them, you realize that it's a couple of dozen. Mm-hmm. But the average person wouldn't be able to tell that.
Yeah.
I would love to see 40 hummingbirds at someone's house around here.
I'll send you the email. So you
I've
can
never seen
up on
anything
that,
even approaching that anywhere around here. But that would be cool.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's a good question. And we got that last month, or one of the last couple of months, we got that question from somebody at Eastham saying that they weren't seeing their normal numbers.
Now, where are
I'm seeing my normal numbers, but sometimes there are local phenomena that are hard to figure out. It's another version of the classic, if you work at a nature center, you know, an Audubon center or whatever, it's like you get a call and on the show here, where are my birds?
Yep. Yep.
Feed the birds and I don't know where your birds are. Yeah. Where did you see them last? Where did you put them? But that's one of these it's a frequently asked question. It's an infrequently answered question because I don't really know because I'm not seeing what you're talking about in my neighborhood or at my office or whatever. So sometimes there are just local things happening that are hard to explain that hopefully are temporary.
Yeah. It's funny how possessive we get of our birds, right?
Our birds. Where are my birds?
Years ago, I had, in the middle of winter, a yellow chat came to my suet feeder.
Oh, yeah, the yellow-breasted chat. That's right.
And so I started, you know, Vern said, oh, they eat nuts. I started sticking stuff in the suet. Well, my neighbor decided to do the same thing. And so my chat was going next door to my neighbor's house.
Right.
And I'm like, what are you doing stealing my bird?
Right. The curious case of the pilfered chat.
Go back and forth between our yards. So that could, you know, somebody else is putting food out. Maybe that's what's happening to some of these birds. There's more
hell
opportunity.
Hell hath no fury like a backyard birder whose neighbor stole their
bird. Stole my bird, I know, right. All right, Tor is giving us a call. Hi, Tor.
Oh, hi, Mindy. Good morning. And Mark, good morning to you.
Hi, Tor.
Hi. I have a question regarding the hummingbirds. I've had discouraging attempts to say, well, my feeders are refilled every 3-4 days. I add new sugar water. And then in a few hours, I'm out there and I say, oh, no, they're ants that have gotten up the pole and then they're getting into the sugar water and they might be putting out formic acid. Does that discourage the hummingbirds? And what I've done is to take petroleum Vaseline jelly and rub that into the pole that supports the bird feeders. And it seems to work for quite some time, but has to be renewed. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good tip. Boy, that stuff, it's good for everything, isn't it?
Yeah.
My mom uses it for everything. It's the duct tape of ointments,
isn't it?
There
you go,
that's a good point. And they sell, I only have two hummingbird feeders, and one of them has the little moat in the center that you're supposed to fill with soapy water that keeps the ants out. So that's another. But if you don't have that, then Get out the Vaseline.
Do the ants bother the hummingbirds care that the ants are there?
It's an interesting point Tor makes about the formic acid, and I've wondered the same thing. Like, distressed ants have these chemical defenses they give off, and I don't know to what extent hummingbirds have a sense of taste or smell. Boy, it'd be nice if they could enjoy the sweet, if they had a sweet tooth and they could enjoy the sweetness. Hopefully they have some sort of sense of taste. So I don't know if anybody's looked at that, whether those insects getting into the, and they die in there. It's just not, as a host, would you serve your
Don't
guests?
want ants
Here.
in the food. Yeah, no, I got
Yeah,
it. Yeah.
here's your mint julep full of dead ants. You wouldn't do that to
No.
your party guests, so don't do it to your
Don't do the
hummingbirds. And there
hummingbirds.
might be chemicals in there that put them off. It's a good question.
All right, another mystery. All right, Michael is giving us a call from East Ham. Hi, Michael.
Hi, good morning. I have a question about suns. I'm actually in Egerton, and I have a house on a small pond off Egerton Great Pond, which is used each year by a pair of swans to raise their young. And normally they keep the other swans out, so you just have the two adults and their cygnets. But this year, about a month ago, a third adult swan joined them, and they're tolerating it. And I just, that's very unusual over the last 20 years, and I didn't know if that was something you knew anything about.
No, about swans and their adoption process. I don't have any firsthand experience with that, but just across the bird world, and people in the wildlife rehabilitation world understand this because they are always looking to rehome some orphan chick. And so if you can find a nest of most birds, they can't count. And so if you can get a similar age chick into a nest of a bird that they will generally adopt it and feed it, whether it's ospreys or house finches. Yes. And so yeah, I don't think they're good at math. And so I who know but where did the other one come from is the interesting question.
So three adults and these cygnets, and they're allowing the adult, so they're not bothered by that third adult.
Oh, it's an adult.
Yeah.
Boy. Good listening skills, bird guy. The third adult. Let's rewind. Click undo. I heard what I thought you were going to say, which sometimes happens. So, yeah, an adult. That could be often the theory there as well. That's one of their young from last year, and so that's a common thing where last year's chicks are sort of hanging around. Certainly eagles and other species where they're the juveniles take multiple years before they're breeding. Yeah, it could be a chick from another year, or it could be that swans don't mind when it gets to a certain point in the nesting season. They're not territorial anymore. They're not worried about driving off intruders during the egg stage and that kind of thing. And at a certain point, territoriality completely breaks down in swans, and they form big flocks, right? And so these big flocks, as you go south and east, there are just more and more. And like the ponds of Rhode Island and southeastern Mass, you'll see dozens of mute swans in the winter, right? And so they're only territorial for a certain period of the nesting season. Then that breaks down, and they form these flocks, and they're using common resources in the fall and winter.
Right, Michael, thank you for the question. Yeah.
I eventually got it right.
You got it. Okay. And we have a listener in Woods Hole said that they're very inspired by the phenomenon of the red knots, who they say, not much bigger than a robin, fatten their livers on all those crab eggs and fly over 2,000 miles. And he notes that we share a gene with migratory
No.
birds. No?
Oh
That's a,
yeah.
no,
Well,
not
I've
true.
yeah, but I've talked to this guy before. Yeah. Next.
Okay.
He
All right. All right.
was yelling at me because I wasn't warning people about fatty liver syndrome or because of birds or something. It
Okay.
didn't really make a lot of sense, but yeah,
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Next one is Ryan, who says he lives in Dartmouth, and every evening I walk the Smith Farms Trail to the observation deck overlooking the Nonquit Marsh. Over the past 3 weeks, on six separate occasions, I've seen and or heard bald eagles. The consistency with which I see them leads me to believe that the pair might have a nest nearby. That seems like a relatively big deal. Any advice on who, if anyone, to contact regarding conservation or research?
I need a recap on this one again.
Okay.
My brain was stuck on fatty liver disease.
So basically he's been seeing bald eagles in Dartmouth.
Right.
And because he's seeing them pretty consistently, he's wondering if they could be nesting nearby. And if they're nesting, who should he tell?
Right. Didn't I already address this? Unless it was somebody else talking about the same eagles. I remember an email exchange with somebody talking about eagles hanging out, and unless you see the nest, and this is something I wanted to talk about anyway, because with the eagle population increasing, there are things I'm trying to figure out too. Like there's a pond where I go a lot in the kind of Brewster Orleans area, and we swim there and fish there with the kids, and there's always a bald eagle, an adult bald eagle there, just quietly hanging out. And occasionally I'll hear it, but it's not like flying around in an obvious way. I don't know of any nest in that immediate area. I don't know why an adult eagle is there. And occasionally it'll come out and chase an osprey, but it really just kind of hangs out in the trees invisibly. And I don't have a particular nest that I can say, okay, that's one of the adults from, right? Because an adult eagle at this time of year has got to be a local nester somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so there are certainly increasing numbers of nests in southeastern Mass. And I believe if this is the same one, I forwarded it to the state wildlife biologists who keep track of all of the eagle nests. But now, like, I get emails like, oh, I saw an adult eagle in Truro. And so, you know, their nesting season is long over. It started in January. And they shouldn't be really feeding the fledglings anymore. And so I think they're just expand where they hang out.
They're just exploring, checking out the neighborhood.
Yeah, yeah, they're not necessarily in the vicinity of their nests anymore. Mm-hmm. And there was some question about the famous Outer Cape eagles that had a nest for a couple years, and then it blew down back in January or February. It was in Orleans, and then we got Orleans Conservation Trust and a couple of us at Mass Audubon were involved in putting that back up. But it in sort of a different place, but then ospreys were there. We lost track of those eagles and never found a new nest site. They didn't come back to the original site. And there was some question, and then a blurry photo emerged of what looked like what could have been a young from this year in that same area where that nest was. And so if anybody knows anything about, was there another nest somewhere in Orleans, East Ham area, I would love to know that. But it's just amazing how hard it is. And like for years and years, like I think they're nesting at Mashpee Wakeby Pond. The state thinks they're nesting at Mashpee Wakeby Pond, but there are big woods all around there. And no one has ever found a nest or any kind of smoking gun carrying sticks and that kind of things, anything really obvious. And so they can hide.
And they're big. It's amazing that they can hide.
Right. You really have to identify a nest during the winter when they would be active at it. They'd be building, mm-hmm. You know, carrying sticks around, you know, and or when they're feeding the chicks, you know, through spring, you know, they're feeding chicks in May and June and then they fledge. But at this time of year, unless you see the nest, it's just an eagle in a tree. Okay. You know, right. We can't say that there's a nest there. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Pamela's giving us a call from New Bedford. Hi, Pamela.
Hi. I always like it when Mark is on your show, Mindy.
Thanks.
Yesterday we went to West Island in Fairhaven, and we'd never been there before, you know, to go to the beach. And we saw these large birds with long orange beaks, and we just said into the Google, you know, shorebird dark shorebird with a long beak, and it came up with black oyster catcher. And it seemed the picture that we saw on the phone, you know, the bird that we saw, but we'd never seen the bird before. We also saw an osprey, which I'd only seen once before, you know, with a fish in its talons. And then what else did we see? I can't remember.
Say, Pamela, if you want to see ospreys, come to Falmouth. We've got plenty of them.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Okay. And that area too, the South Coast, you know, Westport River, Fairhaven. Yeah, there's scads of ospreys there. Just quickly, the Google is a problematic way to, you know, talking into Google can maybe get you there sometimes, but in this case, it got you to the wrong coast. American oyster catcher is the one around here. If you look that up, I think it would more closely match. And I'm sure they're at West Island. That's a great birding spot. It's a well-known birding hot spot on the South Coast there. It's great in migration. It's great in winter.
And catchers are very cool to see. Oyster catchers are awesome.
So cool. And they've been increasing, and they're just, you know, they're eye-catching. They're loud. They're performative and beautiful and interesting. And just the fact that, you know, they're full of fun facts, like they teach their kids the particular preference they have for how they open the muscles and whatever. Do they hammer the adductor muscle, or do they go in through the top, or, you know, they pass that on to their kids. And then they go to Florida, and that's when they actually eat oysters, is when they're in the South. And they eat oysters during the winter in these big flocks and these oyster breaks, places like the Panhandle of Florida. They wait for the oysters to start opening up as the tide comes in, and then gobble them up.
So very cool birds. Would she be better with eBird than Googling eBird?
Merlin. You could run Merlin and maybe it would pick up the sounds. That's a good way to see what's around you. But if you have a phone picture of it, then Merlin has identification. There are multiple things now. The AI, as we know, it just all of a sudden we went from not hearing about it much to it dominates
everywhere,
our lives and our Google searches and summarizing everything we do automatically. But the automatic photo identification AIs in Merlin and iNaturalist would tell you an oyster catcher correctly if you had a, you know, half decent phone picture of one. There are lots of options. And you know, the one that's built into your iPhone photo software is increasingly good with plants, but they'll lead you astray. I mean, the ones that are just for that, like iNaturalist and Merlin, are also not infallible, but they're generally better, and you can get better information. Yeah. A lot of options now. It's a wondrous age for, you know, waving your phone around to tell you what things are around you, putting me out of business.
Hi, Pamela. Thanks for the call. Happy birding. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News This Morning with Mark Faraday. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Got a couple emails. Laurel in West Falmouth says, "We love the bird report. Recently we saw a mourning dove behavior that we'd never seen before. The dove was ground feeding and a chipmunk was getting too close. The dove puffed itself up and raised one wing above its head to defend its turf. Then at one point, the bird and the chipmunk squabbled a bit. Very interesting display of dove defenses. Thanks for the show." It's always fun to watch what they're doing.
Interestingly, hawkish behavior by a dove.
Yeah. Alan's
just goes to show you, don't pigeonhole them.
Ellen is calling from Falmouth. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. I have a question about feeding hummingbirds, which I've been doing for many, many, many years.
Okay.
But this year, I've had a red-bellied woodpecker helping himself to the feeder, and he seems to be getting it because the bubbles go up, and I don't know how he gets in there, except he must have a little tongue that goes through those little holes. But I've never seen that before.
Yeah. Boy, do they... Do they ever have a tongue? A tongue to rival a hummingbird's tongue, maybe even. But yeah,
Oh.
woodpeckers have these famous, their tongue is like the retractable cord of a vacuum cleaner, you know? I don't know if you like pull it quickly, if it snaps back in real quick, but it's sort
Oh
of, it's
yeah.
long and it wraps up and around the skull. And then they use that to get in those holes in the trees to get the carpenter ants and things out. And as long as it can fit in the hole of the hummingbird feeder, then I would
Which
imagine
is
that
amazing, yeah.
they are as well equipped as any bird to get that nectar out of there. And I hear about, I haven't personally seen it at mine, but I've certainly heard about this numerous times of red-bellied and other
Oh, you
woodpeckers
have.
too getting on the hummingbird feeders. But
Yeah, Ellen,
yeah.
thanks for the call. Marianne says, we have three hummingbird feeders with perches around the edge. So we host hummers, downy woodpeckers, cardinals, etc. But the orioles have taken over. Originally just passing by in the spring, they stay all summer. Now with at least five beautiful young birds competing for the feeders. The hummers get in once in a while, so we're thinking of getting another feeder without a perch just for them. We now have ant moats that hang between the branch and the feeders with just plain water, which the other birds like to drink from. We had happily hosted the ants till last year when we discovered they were carpenter ants who also found a way into the house. Marianne, thanks for sharing.
Oh yeah, I'm starting to see ants in the kitchen.
Starting to see what carpenter ants around your house there, Mark? I think you froze up.
They're the big ants. They're oh yeah, you froze up too. So yeah, so I'm gonna have to get those ant baits out. Looks like I don't have a great connection here, but yeah, good point about those separate moats you can buy. To ha it's like a hangar, and then you put you could ideally soapy water so the ants get in, don't just like float off of it. You know, the ant will just be walk on the surface of the water unless you put a surfactant, like, you know, dish detergent on it. But yeah, orioles, a lot of people complain that the orioles come in spring and then disappear. So the fact that you have them all summer and continuing into now when they all with the second period when they disappear is after fledging, and you're just living the dream with nonstop orioles through all of these periods where other people lose theirs. So yeah, enjoy it.
Marilyn in Chatham writes, about 3 weeks ago, I watched a Carolina wren build a nest in our window box. The wren kept stopping by and hopping around the nest, but never laid eggs. This also happened last year. I realized that it may have decided it didn't like the location, but I wondered if wrens might make decoy nests or build multiple nests and pick the best one or something like that. I'm seeing and hearing the wrens every day, so they're still hanging about our yard. Also, we hadn't seen or heard the Orioles for at least 2 or 3 weeks, but then yesterday, a pair of adult Baltimore Orioles had been on the hummingbird feeder suet birdbath. Just wondering if Orioles typically leave the area and then return, or if these might be coming from further north. So first, the Carolina wren. Do they build decoy nests?
Yeah, wrens are famous for this. They call them dummy nests, and some other small species do it too. But yeah, it's not clear why, and it's the males building those, and then it would be the female that probably rejected it. You know, the female just has to pick one. Yeah, so that's interesting. Yeah, and they love window boxes. That's the one Carolina wren nest we had in our yard was on the window box right next to the door we go in and out of constantly, the sliding, you know, sliding door in the back. And they can really hide it in the window box. You know, it's right there, head height. And somehow I missed the fact that a cowbird parasitized, so a female cowbird laid an egg in there. And ultimately, that's all that ca was produced by that nest was a cowbird chick because they're brood parasites. But yeah, I haven't had the experience of dummy Carolina nests, but yeah, wrens definitely do that. And house wrens do it too, until you house wren nests are barely obvious. They're like twigs. They make them out of twigs, and they make them in bluebird houses a lot of times. And so you'll see this twig nest, and you know, sometimes there's one that just never gets used, and that was one of the male's dummy nests.
And then what about the Orioles? They do what they leave and are these do you think they left and came back or are these new birds?
Yeah, so there are these distinct periods. They show up in May, and then numbers build, and by, you know, mid and late May, there's just orioles everywhere. And then they'll sort of disperse. And so the ones that lost the battles or whatever just move on to other territories and they start nesting. They get a little bit quieter, but then the nestling period for orioles is very loud and obvious. They have the loudest, most obvious come and eat me chicks. I don't know how any of them fledge. It's like they're calling the blue jays to come eat them, but they're just constantly making chattering sounds in the that beautiful hanging nest that orioles make waiting to be fed. And then they keep making that sound after they fledge. And so like at Wellfleet Bay Sanctuary, where I mostly work there, there's a period in July. They're just everywhere. Everywhere you go, you're hearing young orioles. You're out in the middle of the marsh and they're flying across the marsh, you know, from hundreds and hundreds of yards to get from one patch of forest to the other. And so they're dispersing. And if you're not somewhere they disperse to, then your orioles can disappear. So if you had them breeding in your neighborhood, I'm not really hearing them in my neighborhood lately. But if you're somewhere where they are dispersed to and they settled in for a while to, you know, feed and fatten up before migration, and they, most of them leave in late summer, like September, we will get a few Baltimore Orioles that stay for the winter. And it seems to be a phenomenon that's on the rise, especially as people are catching on to it and keeping jelly feeders out in the winter and sometimes getting multiple Orioles that stay all through the winter. That was true in Barnstable. There's a place in Dennis, Orleans. I could think of several places. And when you go do the Christmas counts, sometimes you'll find little like two or three Orioles somewhere eating like bittersweet fruits and that sort of thing. So they have all these different phases of their life, but what they're supposed to do is go to, you know, Costa Rica and spend the winter in an orange grove poking holes in oranges or what, you know, whatever else they do down there, and then come back in May. But so you could either be somewhere that gets them or somewhere that doesn't get them right now. So if you've got them, then be thankful. Yeah.
This is a really good time to be out on a whale watch, not just because of the whales, but because of the birds, right? I mean, this is seeing all kinds of great reports coming off of the whale watches.
Well, it's a little bit of a light year for the birds, as I talked about, I think, last week. I finally got on. I haven't been on a whale watch in years. And you can get on a whale watch where you might see dozens of quarry shearwaters and maybe some manx and some sooty, some great shearwaters, the four species of shearwaters that you hope to get. If you're a birder going on a whale watch, you expect that you will see four species of shearwaters that you otherwise wouldn't be able to easily see from land unless you went out to Race Point or got lucky on one of the east-facing beaches or something like that. You kind of have to be out on a boat to expect to see shearwaters and storm petrels, and you hope for, you know, lots of roseate terns out there, these federally endangered terns. But the one I went on was very quiet for birds. Few and far between.
A long time ago, though, right? I mean, because right now, aren't there, you know, like...
Well, it was 2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago. Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. And so, no, it was getting, you know, sort of peak season, but it gets better. But, you know, other people are getting more. It's just this particular one where the whales were, and the whales were great. And we had this performative young humpback in the what is usually the doldrums, sort of halfway between Plymouth and P-Town, where we were just, the whale watch was over. We were just cruising back. And then all of a sudden this whale just starts breaching, just, you know, smashing down right next to the boat. It was just, everyone, yay, it was clapping. It was just what you hope for in a whale watch. It was fantastic. But we were scrounging for birds on this particular one. But we did see quarry shearwaters, like two. We did see some Wilson storm petrels, which are just fantastic little birds that come up from Antarctica on their fluttery little wings with their pattery little feet. They're so fun to watch. And we did get close looks at a couple that were on like an oil slick that was probably left behind by menhaden getting chomped by tuna or stripers or something. They're, you know, Wilson storm petrels like to find these oil slicks. The petrels and shearwaters have an excellent sense of smell. So for many, many years, it was thought that birds in general didn't have a sense of smell. For the most part, I think that's mostly true. But, you know, since fairly recently, we've learned that vultures do, which you wouldn't think would be a great advantage to a vulture to smell the awful thing. But I guess they have to find awful, haha. But I guess they do have to find that stuff. I think once they get on it, it wouldn't be great to be able to smell that terrible putrid things you're eating. But seabirds are the particularly tube noses, this group of birds that, if you look closely, they have a little sort of a tube over their nostrils that must serve for directionality and concentration of smells. So they can smell their way around the ocean, smelling these things that, we would never notice, but like chemicals given off by phytoplankton being grazed by zooplankton.
Wow.
Somehow some chemicals are released by that, some volatile chemicals, and they can smell that. And so the ocean to them is a scent map of productive and unproductive areas. If you think about that, it kind of has to be that way. How else? We've been out in the vast trackless ocean where you can't see land in any direction. Like how disorienting and desert-like that is for landlubbers like us. They're not fish. They live in the air. They need to be able to find food. They can't stay out there indefinitely without finding food. And so for them, it's scent. And Wilson storm petrels are in that group of tube noses, and they're little more. They're like little swallows of the sea. But just watching them patter, they patter with their feet, sort of like skipping along the surface, bouncing with their little webbed feet, looking for little bits of stuff, bits of fish and small fish and shrimp and zooplankton and things like that. But also oil, like from menhaden, which is what the tuna are all eating menhaden out there right now in the bay and off of Provincetown, and they're very oily. Great for storm petrels.
Only got about a minute and a half left, but I want to mention a lot of puffin sightings off of Race Point, and that's what we usually might see one, but
Yeah,
what's
but and
happening?
not now. I don't know if it's just more people are getting out to Race Point more often than say 20 years ago, and so a straggler puffin from the colony in Maine or whatever is just dispersed and comes down here. But there've been multiple. Someone saw a couple of people saw two off of Pamlet Harbor and Truro, and there's been one around that people have seen both from the Provincetown whale watch boats and from land at Race Point. Birders who go out to Race Point and look for seabirds have seen puffins. I've never seen this many sightings, even if it's just a few individuals. I've never seen this many reports of a puffin over this long of a period during the summer. So, will that become a new trend once people start realizing they're out there and looking for them more? You're not likely to see one unless you trudge your way out to Race Point, or if someone happens to catch it and point it out when you're going by on the whaleboat. But yeah, you just never know. It's the common theme for all this. You never know. Birds have wings, and you never know where they're going to end up. And that's what gets us out of bed in the morning.
And the whale watches, like you said, the whales have been great. So again, good time to
Yes.
get out there, because not every year, it's not, there are not a lot of whales out there every year. So it's, this year's
Right.
good season for it. So get out on a whale watch. You never know what you might see, right? All right,
Yes.
Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary, joins us the second Tuesday of every month. As always, thank you, Mark.
All right, catch you next time.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.